Hello, and welcome back to another episode of SLA, Second Language Acquisition for Everyone. I'm here, I'm Bill. He, him,
It's Ben.
yeah, and Ben.
Sorry.
it's fine. So, we got Bill and Ben here, and today we're going to talk a little bit about the interaction hypothesis, which might ring some bells for people. But before we dive into that, Ben, do you have any updates, news, information?
Absolutely, William. So the book study, our book study of proficiency-based instruction teaching grammar for proficiency by Ritz and Travers is coming to a close. We are reading up on chapter 7, which is the final chapter. There's some closing thoughts right after, so we'll lump that in as well. But we're finishing up chapter 7 the week of November 10th through 14th, so the week after this podcast releases. And so we'll be wrapping up that final chapter, talking about form-focused feedback. And then on November 18th, so the following Tuesday, we will be releasing an episode of the pod with our esteemed colleague, Stacey Bukowski, who has been coming along with us on the book study, kind of
And we're super
summarizing.
grateful for her. Yeah, she's been doing great.
Love Stacey, huge Stacey fan. But we are going to be kind of summarizing our learning and takeaways from this and maybe mapping out next steps or wonderings, things where we want to learn more. I mean, I'm looking forward to that because Stacey is incredibly thoughtful, just as Bill is. And so I'm looking forward to kind of summarizing what we've
And just
learned.
as Ben is.
So that's coming again, chapter 7, the 10th through the 14th. We post a question every day across our socials. And then on the 18th, you'll hear our next podcast episode with Stacey.
Right. So I think that's like all the housekeeping. And so let's get into it. And how have we gaslit ourselves about the interaction hypothesis? I guess we should probably make sure we lead with the definition just so we're all on the same page. But so we have the input hypothesis proposed by Krashen in the 80s, saying like all you need is input, or input's really important, or whatever your takeaway from that is. And then Michael Long comes along a few years later and introduces the interaction hypothesis, which is known under a couple different names, essentially saying that not only do we need input for language acquisition, but we also need to have interactions with the language. With, I think, the definition in the article that we read said with native speakers, but we're looking at classroom application, of course. So, like, what is
Or proficient
interaction
speakers of the language.
or proficient? Yeah, exactly. And I mean, they did have some, we'll get into it, but they had some interesting insights as well about how native speakers interact with non-native speakers, which I thought was pretty interesting. But I think one of the things that I've gaslit myself about with the interaction hypothesis is defaulting to just giving a quick English translation for something. That I mean, it's really quick. It takes like 2 seconds. But as like we'll find out in the article, like is it doing all of like the cognitive stuff that we want it to do by just giving students a quick translation? Which by no means am I saying that you shouldn't. I do it all the time because it is the quickest way to ensure comprehension. But what I found, and especially with like Spanish 4, I need to do better about like leading students to the meaning of words rather than just giving it to them, especially when it's words like if it's like, you know, sometimes there are students that are like, how can I say this? Which oftentimes in like in assessment settings, I tell students, I'm not going to tell you how to say anything. I'm not going to give you the vocabulary. However, I'll probably help you like problem solve, like to use the language that you do know, but you get to some points where like it's really hard to define a word even smaller than it is. Like so like with like high frequent like super high frequency words like Super 7, Sweet 16, whatever you like.
And category words
I'll
for nouns too kind of also go into that.
But like how do you further define have in, like, you could use synonyms, sure, but in Spanish, at least, tener is really, really useful word. So in those cases, like, I'd be like, I don't know how to simplify the word, what you want to say anymore. Then, like, it's already pretty simple. So that's when I'm usually like, sorry, just see if you can continue the assessment without trying to say that.
Yeah, talk around it as much as you can. I'm
Yeah.
with you that, like, I have been guilty, I think, of saying a word once, saying really quickly what it means that means in English, and then just moving on. But I think that it takes us parking on new words, new vocabulary for a while for it to become useful input for the student system and also for them to have a chance to acquire it kind of at all. And so I think introducing a word, for instance, like writing it on the board and then asking a bunch of questions using that word is a strong tactic. But I have definitely been guilty of gloss something in English very quickly and then move on.
Yeah, and same with like TPR. I'm trying to incorporate more TPR because like I find value in the like both sides of the brain kind of stuff, movement and language, and it just like helps. At least my understanding is that it helps build connections because not only do you have like a meaning for the word from maybe a translation, but you also have like a gesture or something, a body movement. There have been so many times where a student's like, how do you say whatever? And like, I'll do the TPR gesture. And they're like, oh yeah. But I will be like, a word will come up and I'll use the gesture. And I think I probably just need to be more explicit with students. Like, if I use the gesture, I want you to use the gesture too so that we can like get into it more. But like, sometimes same thing. I do it once and then I forget to continue using the gesture. And then they're like, what's that mean? I'm like, oh yeah, I didn't give you enough park on it long enough. Something that I kind of did the other day, we were doing like a look at just to review some vocabulary. And so I took a look at like the lowest scores and then we just circled around that for a while. So the verb was, the word was desempeñar, to like to play a role in like a movie or something. So we asked about, so I started asking students like, okay, what character has been played by multiple people? And who do you think played it best? Why do you think Tom Holland played Spider-Man better than Tobey Maguire?
Because you're young and wrong.
Well, yeah, you know the first two were great. The third one, it was a little weird, but yeah. So I think not taking the opportunities to interact with new vocabulary is probably like my big gaslight. That's something that I need to. I mean, I am conscious of it, you know, in the moment. It's not an in the moment thing for me yet to just hop on that. Like, oh yeah, here's a new word.
On it.
Let's stay on it for a while.
I think that, yeah, that kind of ties into as ACTFL approaches, I'm thinking of my first ACTFL. And my first ACTFL, I was in my first year of teaching, and I was like, yeah, in my student teaching, we did 90% target language because I took over a level two class. And then I was teaching mostly level one students in Spanish at a middle school. And I was like, how do we do this right now? Like, and so I went to a lot of sessions at my first ACTFL about 90% target language usage because I knew in myself I was backing away from it. So either trying to give some sort of instructions that I had thought up ahead of time or on the spot in the target language, looking around and seeing that everyone was confused, and then being just like, I just said this, and then like moving on because I got nervous. Like, or when there's that like hanging misunderstanding in a classroom, you just like your body starts feeling all like shaky and nervous, and then you feel like you're losing the class, and then they're going to start goofing off. And so you just like try to get them to where you want them to go as fast as possible. And of course, the first language or the common language is going to be the easiest way to get there, but that is not what we're teaching. And there are skills and ways to deliver the same instructions or, you know, deliver the same instruction in a more comprehensible way using comprehensible language, using the variety of tools like TPR and gestures and all the sorts of things that we'll talk about. But I wasn't there yet. And I went to my state's language conference either that year or the year after, and I saw Paul Sandrock, who was a longtime director of education for ACTFL and is the author of one of the Keys books that I can see in my room. And he had shared that there was research that students come into a language class anticipating that they're going to hear a lot of target language, that the teacher is probably going to talk a lot of Spanish. They're going to talk a lot of French or German or Chinese or Japanese. They anticipate that. But it's the teachers who talk themselves out of it, that we say like, oh, I don't know if they're going to get it, or I don't feel like I have the skills to do it in the language, so they just don't. Or, as we know, sometimes they're teaching something very abstract like grammar rules and procedures like that and are like, but how would I do that in the target language? I don't think we do. I don't think that's what you teach generally. So yeah, it's the teachers that talk ourselves out of it, that like, we think, oh, students aren't going to get it. Then they're going to get mad. Then they're going to get mad at me and the language, not want to learn anymore, shut down. Everything's going to go into chaos and it's going to be whatever. So I'm going to allow myself all this English in order to facilitate things continuing to happen or have the appearance of happening in my class. And there's no shame about this. Again, I think this is something I think about all the time, which is how to increase the amount of target language that I use, even if I feel now that I am so much significantly further of where I was when I was going to all those ACTFL sessions looking for the gems that would save my first year language classes. So not talking yourself out of it, I think, is a good place to start.
Yeah. And Nick, believe in yourself. You can do it.
Even the Slate Podcast,
we can do
says,
hard things.
You got this, girl. Get in there. Use the target language.
But yeah, I think that's essentially like the kind of like a pitfall, at least of mine, and maybe some others out there, that like we do back away a little bit. I do have a poster in my room that says like 90% Espanol, 10% Inglés, and like give examples of when like it's appropriate. So like the 10%, I try to like, I think the things that I have on it are like, if someone's in danger, obviously like communicate in the most efficient language, right? Which is going to be our shared language. And like reflection stuff, I sometimes, depending on what they're reflecting on, right, do some, like English is usually fine for that for me, but, or like when it's like the one word or something that we just need to like pop up. Or like back in the day, I heard Dr. Terry Waltz say something about like, we have so many, I saw like a demo video from her saying like, you can like do two words in English to get your point across, which was a great starting point for me. And now I'm just like looking at it and like, I'm trying to build in reflection at the end of class. I haven't done it yet, but I'm trying to build in reflection at the end of class to ask students like, okay, this was our goal. Our goal was that like our communication is 90% in Spanish. Like, how close do you think we were to our goal today? So trying to build in
that
reflective
piece. Would you be willing
to
share your like your posters that you use for those purposes?
Yeah, for sure.
And I'll put those in the show notes. And I think something I've used is a reflection on the amount of target language usage by the teacher and the student, individual student, which is one of those washback effect things where if I know I'm going to give that reflection to the students because I have it printed out and it's on my desk for everyone, then I am like, oh, I should teach more in the target language. So sometimes you just have to like incept the idea into your mind that you're going to use even more target language and then just go for it.
Yeah. Like I'm very scatterbrained all the time. And so I have to have like reminders to myself for a lot of things. But like one of the things that I try to do is make sure that I've got like, I have a sign in the back of the classroom, or at least I have had a sign in the back of the classroom, like to remind myself about like use more target language, and like some like classroom management affirmations and stuff that like I just need to see, because so it's not out of my mind. I'll share that poster. And yeah. All right, on to the article. Let's ungatekeep this, Ben.
Let's hit it. Okay, so for this episode, Bill and I read The Impact of Interaction on Second Language Acquisition and Listening by Adu, Abunya, Owusu, and Budu. This was published in the Journal of Languages for Specific Purposes. And there, here's what they were going for. So they were trying to see the effects of interactionally modified input. That means that the teacher is not just reading from an instruction sheet or reading from a story or a text or anything, that they're adjusting the input based on the reactions and needs of their own students. So what effects did that interactionally modified input have on the listening comprehension of their students? So if they allowed for interaction, did it make them comprehend more or less? And what kind of modifications are made to input to make input more comprehensible to learners? So their hypotheses were that students would score better on tasks if the teacher made efforts to not just give canned input, even if that canned input was already modified to be more comprehensible. The interaction would help the students score higher on listening tasks, and that would increase the amount of language that input that students got. In the literature review, they review the input hypothesis that we need comprehensible input in order to acquire a language, and briefly discuss the optimal input hypothesis, which has been pushed forward by Krashen and Benico Mason in recent years, that input needs to be interesting, rich, and abundant. And also talk about how in an article by Zhang in 2009, that the essential ingredients for language acquisition are input, interaction, and output. And then if you're missing one of these things, there's going to be a marked effect on the fluency of the learner. I came away from that asking myself what the balance is. But again, I think that's what we're all trying to figure out. They also talked about the interaction hypothesis, basically that not only is comprehensible input necessary for second language acquisition, modifications to the interactional structure of conversations take place in negotiating a communication problem help make input more comprehensible.
Yeah, and then a note on that. In the interaction hypothesis, as proposed by Long, there were two things. The first thing is comprehensible input is necessary for second language acquisition. And then onto the modification. So like you have to start with comprehensible input, but from my understanding, the interaction is helping us be even more comprehensible.
Totally. Something that underlies the statement that I read from the article just now is also that you need to be communicating about something real in order for this to happen. You can't, you know, teaching abstract grammar rules doesn't quite fit the bill for this. And talking about the language doesn't really, that's not what most people are looking to do with a language when they learn it. And so in order to solve a communication problem, you need to actually be expressing and interpreting and sometimes negotiating meaning for a given purpose in a given context. Hello. Thanks to BVP for that one. They talk some more about some research about interaction and touch on Swain's output hypothesis that the interaction is when learners are testing hypotheses about the language, and that interaction helps with lexical acquisition and production, and that interaction helps listening comprehension when teachers perform comprehension checks, confirmation checks of details, and clarification requests, because that leads to repetition and rephrasing, aka more input, more listening input, more listening fluency. So the researchers in this study, we're looking to essentially build on the work of previous researchers into interaction stuff and see if they did, if they did interactionally modified input, is that going to make their students have better listening comprehension? And what exactly is that look like? So they planned this around a game to be played. And the game seemed pretty simple, pretty straightforward. Students were picking up pictures of objects or people that were specific and required specific descriptions and placing them with some accuracy. And that was the whether or not they got a point for it was whether or not they placed it accurately on the background. So think, I don't know, you have, just as an example, this isn't what they did, but think you have a basket of fruit in front of you, and then you have like a bunch of children sitting at a cafeteria, and it's like, give the girl with the long blonde hair the orange. And so you have to place it in the right way, just as an example of the sort of task. The students that they selected were intermediate, low intermediate students in their proficiency based on a reading test that they provided to the students to kind of pick for the study. Now, the N, which means the number of participants in the study, and this is rather low, it's 8. So we take anything with an N that low with a grain of salt, but we will also consider whether or not it confirms the hypotheses and the research that comes before. This is a, you know, research. I've been thinking about this, about how science and research is not a quest for one single answer that just appears like Excalibur or something, that it is an ocean of results that forms into one body of water that we see clearly. And so just as an aside for that, the end of this is rather low, but it is building on and referencing research in similar fields. The other thing is they're talking about what modifications happen in this linguistically, interactionally modified input. And they're looking for input that is slightly less complex than what a native speaker would say in the same situation. So they're going to use more high-frequency lexical items and less complex sentence structures. They'll probably use a greater quantity than a native speaker because they're not using that super complex vocabulary. They're using vocabulary suited to low intermediate speakers. And it might be redundant as well, again, because we're trying to give more input. We're trying to get repetitions of useful words, and we're kind of giving our students another chance to hear these things. So less complex, more abundant, more repetitious. Now, they had one group, the control group, that was given input that they, in instructions for the task, that were already modified. They were already made to be less complex than what a native speaker would say. They were made, you know, scaled down to that, the scale of a learner. And then the experimental group was given explanations that were more interactional, that were more allowed for negotiation of meaning and for the many things that we do as teachers to make input more comprehensible. What ended up happening is that interactionally modified input led to better comprehension and performance. Who'd have thunk it? The students in the experimental group scored 18% higher on the tasks. I think any of us, if we were out here looking for an intervention that would cause our students to score 18% higher on assessments, we'd probably take that one. They were better able to pick the correct objects for placement and put them in the right spots. And so they were able to solve a communication problem of placement, location, description, those sorts of things. And so great, cool. That's great. Awesome. The other thing is that they were looking into what qualitatively is happening to the input when it is pre-modified versus interactionally modified. So the one that allowed for the teacher to negotiate meaning a little bit more. There was a large increase in the quantity of input provided. So they were providing more input to their students. And as we know, we're just trying to jam their brain. We have so little time with our students in the United States at the secondary level for language that we are just trying to jam as much input into their brain as humanly possible. And so increased quantity is always desired. There is also increased redundancy, which again means that they're getting repetitions, but meaningful repetitions of the target vocabulary for the
robust exposure, one might say.
Robust exposure. True that. The complexity actually was not that different. So a teacher in an interactional setting is probably going to make similar choices to somebody who is making choices in the moment to... Wait, let me rephrase that. When they pre-modified the input away from the complexity of what a native speaker would say, they made similar choices as the choices a teacher would probably make in the moment to make things less complex. And so they used similarly high-frequency vocabulary and cut down on the amount of new or maybe more advanced lexical items. So it increased in quantity and redundancy. That's what the interaction did. So students are getting more input, and it's more repetitious. So the conclusion is that we need more interaction in our lessons. Students need more interaction as they're receiving input. And we need to keep replicating the studies with more groups, different groups, and maybe examine more the differences in complexity that were in the pre-modified input and the interactually modified input. They didn't quite get to that in their study as well. But they, you know, they highlight how essential language skills, this take place in Ghana. They're highlighting how essential it is to have strong English skills and that they really need best practice. And we need it too here in the United States. We want students to feel successful in our classes, to maintain enrollment in our programs. I always think of Liam Printer's references to self-determination theory, that competence, autonomy, and relatedness are what help someone feel motivated. And this plays very much into the competence piece, that it's hard to feel good at something if you're not comprehending, if your teacher is not making adjustments to help you understand. And so interaction is really, really essential for language teachers. So we could all use a little bit more interaction. And consider that ungatekept. Ungatekept.
Thanks. Yeah, I don't know. I still don't know. We've been doing this for a year. I still don't know what
I said it so confidently and then immediately was like, wait a minute. Oh, boy.
All right. So some girl bossing. Girl bossing, some interaction.
My number one thing that came up to me, again, like in a vision after I read this article, is how important it is, the kind of old TPRS adage of teaching to the eyes. It is hard to know what your students are not comprehending, and whether or not your rephrasing and all the other good stuff that you could do is having the intended effect or working if you don't look at your students. I have a student teacher this year, and I talked to her about how when I get nervous or like worked up during a class, I do the old like public speaking thing of just looking above the heads of my students and just saying stuff to kind of no one. And taking the time to really look at each student in the eyes gives you a very clear read of whether or not they're coming along. And obviously you want to do other comprehension checks and other ways to ascertain their acquisition and comprehension, but teaching to the eyes, that kind of TPRS fundamental technique, I think is so important when trying to increase the amount of interaction that you're having.
And on that, something that I saw, if you teach Gen Z students, you might have, at least over the summer, I haven't heard it recently, but you might have heard of the Gen Z stare. And like when I learned that this was not just a me thing, and that like other teachers were experiencing this, where the students are just kind of like staring, like they're really good at having like stone face. And I'm like, okay, but like, you're nodding along and stuff, like you're acting like you understand, but your production and comprehension are telling a different story. So don't fake it. But yes, that was something that I thought about. But it also, in a video that I saw, it was to help us to understand, to not take that personally. Like, it's not just happening to you. Like, it's a thing that is at least like informally documented. So like, that's the challenge when it comes to like teaching to the eyes, but just keep going through it. It freed me up actually a little bit this year, I think, like understanding that it's not just me. I'm not just like saying stupid things all the time. That's opened me up to just being able to ask more questions and stuff, because like, it's not that they're not listening necessarily. It's just, I mean, I have my own thoughts about why it happened, partly because like we've learned a lot from video in recent years, and video does not require you to react. But I mean, that's, citation needed, but yeah, that's a thought that I had about that.
Me think of what Claudia Elliott said on her podcast once, which was of like training students how to react, that like it is just polite and makes you sound, and you know, in quotation marks, makes you sound like a native speaker, it makes you sound like a German person, to use things like rejoinders in a natural way, partly as a way to show that engagement. I think Bill and I are millennials, and when we are giving stand-up the comedy shows for our life in front of seventh period and they are not responding, we're like, what is happening? But we want this. So we want that to know that they are interacting with the input and then it's not just like floating over their brains, but also that it is a way to show comprehension, right? If a student uses some sort of positive phrase about something positive, then that means they understood that it was a good thing, right? That they had this kind of abstract like category understanding. Or that if you tell them something that is sad or tragic or something and they have some sort of reaction that is congruent with that, then again, they have demonstrated comprehension in a different way. And so sometimes it is just teaching students, I need you to react, partly as a way to like show me that you're getting it, but partly as a way to sound even more like this target language community, because isn't that cool? And as we know from the episode that we did about collocations and three-word phrases and stuff, that also makes them sound more fluent.
Something that I've done with rejoinders is I bought these like sticky business card holders. And so they're just like 3-inch by 2-inch little sticky things. And I stuck them on my desk. And then I printed off some rejoinder cards. So I just slip them in there. And like the plan is to like change them every so often, but that hasn't happened. And kids are starting to fidget and peel them off. So I have to like go back and at some point I have to like redo those, but I tried to make them like very accessible to the students so that they can have those like real interaction moments. Additionally, like I've used for class discussions, for example, I've used Carrie Toth's Discussion Thursday rubric that's on somewheretoshare.com. You can look that up. But essentially you set a goal for students, like you have to get so X many points for during the conversation. So like a point, I give students like a point if they respond to my question, 2 points if they ask an original question, half a point, up to 3 points for rejoinders. So like they could do 6 rejoinders, but like I'm not going to let you just get your points just by saying que bueno or estoy de acuerdo 20 times. And that's helped. I haven't actually used that for a while. I need to take a look back at that. I've even tried to implement that as a weekly thing. So like set your goal for the week to students and then like try to meet that goal. And then another thing with kind of rejoinders is not only do I like to do gestures from time to time, but I also have sound effects for words. So teaching the word, like the phrase, like to have fun. So anytime that someone says like have fun, we just go woo, because we're having a blast. Or like I'll give them, if I know that like there's some like unfortunate events in a reading that we're doing or a story that we're doing, I'll make sure to like point out like things like poor thing, and así es la vida, that's life. And then I'll tie rejoinders to specific words as well.
Yeah. I think one other way that I have kind of increased my girls' bossedness, besides the use of rejoinders, like Bill said, that just makes class so much more fun. And also, not that this is the point, but when an observer comes in and your kids are like responding in a funny way to things that are happening, it is very slay. But I think the skills of paraphrasing are essential for us to develop as language teachers, that we, you know, have become advanced or maybe are even native speakers of the language we're teaching. And we need to learn those skills of paraphrasing. And so giving yourself many opportunities to do just that. Again, a tip that for some reason like blew my mind and I keep thinking about is the use of category words. So instead of learning specific, every single specific, like, oh, that is a very specific dish, that is a very specific clothing item, that is a da 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 da, you can just say, that is a special article of clothing that you wear to a party, that you wear to this festival, that you wear to this, to kind of aid students in seeing, you know, in those category words are higher frequency and more useful anyways, but also it's a bit of circumlocution. And so we need to practice that in ourselves. Mason and Krashen, as part of the story listening project, have worked a lot on how to provide optimal input in their comprehension aiding supplementation. And they one thing that has come out of that also is synonym stacking. So taking, you know, a word like big and hitting it with enormous, huge, gigantic, words that are all in the same, you know, are roughly synonyms, to increase the richness and abundance of the input and provide students with the meaningful repetitions for their vocab.
I like that too. Like I do like a hand gesture for synonyms, and it's like it's cognate E in Spanish, but so I'll tell them like one word and like, oh, like synonymous.
And our listeners can't see Bill, but he just did the
six-sided gesture. Yeah, I was doing like a...
I am about to leave this chat. The podcast is over, everyone. This is going to come out
after Halloween, but I am going to school tomorrow dressed as a sick seven.
You're going to jail. We had a German exchange student come to our class, and he said, that was over in Germany at the beginning of the summer. And I said, listen to him, please.
All right. Ben, anything else?
I would just say that, like, there's a lot to be said. The things that we talk ourselves out of are, like, gestures in general, kind of like we talked about earlier with TPR and things. But I think also modeling exactly what we want our students to do.
Oh,
so if I'm saying, have a discussion with your partner and react appropriately and, like, all this sort of stuff, you can also just go, you know, to a student in the class who's going to catch on quickly and who you think is down for that sort of thing. Do exactly the task that you want the students to later do with each other. Show, you know, say, hi, name of child. How are you? I'm good. Thank you. Like, how are you? Oh, I'm good. Thank you so much. What is your favorite? This and that, you know, just do the whole interaction. It's not giving anything away for them to receive that input. That is a way to modify it, is to model the exact thing that you're asking the students to do.
Yeah. Slay. So,
slay. I think we slayed it, Bill. Even though you're going to prison for the 6-7 gesture, but that isn't, I mean, if it helps students, if it helps students know that they're synonyms, then maybe the International Criminal Court will allow it.
We'll see. We'll see. I'll let you know if I get a court date.
We'll catch you on the other side, Bill.
All right. Thanks for listening to everyone. Until next time, go out there and slay.
Bye.
Bye.